This issue of Audio Arts begins at the second International Contemporary Art Fair at Olympia in London. Right, well, we're starting at the Civilian Warfare Gallery from New York, and I'm sitting with the director. I was wondering if we could actually start by you responding to the context of the fair here in London.
The context of the fair? Well, I think it's a little bit unusual that there are so few galleries here that represent people outside of England, really. Most of the work here is British art, and there are only three or four people from the States, from New York, and very few of the big names from Europe. I think that's a little bit unusual. I don't think it's necessarily a problem, but I'm suffering from the quality of the work isn't really as strong as I think it could be.
So what would you say is the policy or the attitude of the gallery? Because obviously the work, looking at it here, has a particular kind of quality.
A lot of British people have said that, and I don't really feel that it has. It's not a particular style. I think it's a very eclectic group. We're not like a graffiti gallery. A lot of our artists had origins in street art. They actually did paintings on the street, but they aren't graffiti artists. And there seem to be, I mean, to my eye, there are a lot of different painterly traditions going on. There's a lot of sculpture. And they don't really relate to each other in a clear way. Basically, we look for the best that we could find.
But, I mean, how would they be distinguished from any other artist? I mean, do you consciously have a particular policy about the artists you show?
They tend to be young, but that's sort of changing. Our newest addition is a 62-year-old artist from California who's never had a gallery in New York before. His name is Arnold Meshes. And so overall, they tend to be young, and people say that there is a certain kind of civilian warfare look, and it's basically a lot of energy, work that has a lot of integrity to it, a lot of individuality. What would you say?
There's a lot of juxtaposition of the images or in terms of the techniques that are used. It's a lot of recycling of materials. Like, the one thing that's very much in common between these people, whether it's Bill Rolfing, who uses fish and fish skins, which is recycling of a natural material, or Jane Bauman, who's recycling lithoplates, lithographers, metal, and using that for art. And also within the work, like in Jane's work, there's a mixture of sort of an abstract expressionist kind of background that's juxtaposed against a very graphic kind of image. So I think if there's an image about the gallery, it's a really diverse, it really represents like a pluralistic attitude towards art in New York. But I mean, the things that seem to run through are like these two things, the reuse or recycling of materials or the juxtaposition of images. And even Arnold, this 62-year-old man who is painting, who we're showing now, uses, like, he'll make a remake of a classical painting like The Rapt of the Medusa or Liberty Leading the People or Goya's The Colossus or something, and then he'll juxtapose against that a more political but socially contemporary image that makes, like, a joke about this correlation between those things, so...
So now around the corner from the Civilian Warfare Gallery, the Fun Gallery New York. Perhaps, again, we could begin by you responding. Are you the director of the Fun Gallery?
The manager.
How have you responded to the fair? I mean, what has the response been to the Fun Gallery?
People seem very interested in what we're doing. Everybody's, you know, wanting to know exactly what's going on, and, you know, they like the work. It's very exciting for them. They're a little hesitant about purchasing any, I think, because much more conservative than this work is. But I've had a lot of interest. I don't know what that will produce sales.
Right. Now, the work is, of course, known about in this country now, the graffiti work, or work that's sort of arisen from graffiti activities in New York. Where is all that at now? I mean, obviously we know about Keith Haring and so on. I mean, how would you define the moment in terms of artists working in this way in New York?
Well, it's become very popular to do the work on canvas because it's very difficult right now for them to do the work on the trains. They've become very strict about it. So very few of the kids are actually doing work on the trains. So everybody's working on canvas and paper. We have some smaller drawings over here that a bunch of the young kids did. We put word out on the street that we were accepting drawings from kids, and they came in droves, hundreds of them with small drawings. So everybody's very eager to, you know, get their work, you know, get the approval of having their work be art. So.
Right. I mean, terms such as tribal and street level have been applied to this area of work and so on. And of course, you know, when it actually then becomes a fine art kind of commodity, then I suppose it's possible that all sorts of things can change and so on, and dangers of reappropriation and exploitation and so on. I mean, how do you think, I mean, does the work really travel onto canvas that readily and then into an art fair? Is there any kind of conflict you see there or not?
I don't find a conflict simply because, what's the definition of art? To me, it's, you know, if somebody applying their talent to paper, canvas, whatever, why is that art any more than this? I don't understand what the big stink is about the whole thing.
Well, it's not necessarily a stink, but I mean, it becomes something else, I suppose, if it's ephemeral on the edge of a subway train. And then it becomes a kind of commodity in a gallery.
But nevertheless, it's still a talent that these kids have to do this. They've never had any formal training whatsoever. They've never had any kind of training. I mean, these kids that come in, you know, have just mimicked what they've seen, you know, some of the older, you know, grandfathers of graffiti do. And it's certainly a talent to be able to sit down and do pieces like that. I can't do them. You know, I mean, they're artists in their own way, in what they're doing. I mean, not any more than anybody else. I don't really see why there's, you know, the big question. I think that it's, if somebody appreciates it as a, you know, a visual piece, then it's art to them.
Right.
Why shouldn't they purchase it?
Right. Well, now I'm at the stand of the Bahrain Art Society. Perhaps you would tell me, you're Mr. Sheriff, what your response to being here at Olympia is at the second International Art Fair.
I think mainly, well, I must say at the beginning that we learned about this art fair quite late. But I think it could have been established much more. I got some point about the organizers, which I think they are a little bit delayed in the construction of the exhibition. In particular our stand, we got the lights the day after, which is truly, when the press came, I don't know if you read the Guardian, it became, you know, a negative point.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is one. There's another point which I don't think really we can change about it, is the qualities of the galleries exhibiting. It's a sort of a mix-up. You can see an excellent thing, really good works of art, and suddenly you can see really very bad art. And I don't know how things like this could be controlled. On the other hand, we appreciate the communication we had with the public here, and it indeed showed the reaction of the publics we had in our stand. It showed that truly the London audience of art is sophisticated in the way we saw how they go to certain paintings. Now, of course, I don't know, but I think there's about 5,000 or 6,000 visitors a day here. But this is so far to what I think about this fair. What I think would be better, probably this fair should have been in a different time of the year. Winter, I don't think it's a good time for it.
Well, this now is the Coracle Press Gallery stand at the art fair. Simon, have you got any particular reactions to the fair so far?
It's been an interesting publicity venture for us, really, I think, more than we haven't sold much work. And I'm quite surprised we haven't sold some of the smaller pieces, say, of Yoko Taraci or Bill Colbert, especially, and Tony Haywood, perhaps. But I begin to see the logic of it now. And I'm glad that we actually are situated in Camberwell. And I realise that if we moved to Cork Street, it wouldn't make any difference to this particular problem, because I think what's missing in England is a certain class of collector that I think exists in Belgium and Holland and Germany, a young professional type of collector who can get interested in art maybe, and I don't think we have that class of collector here. You know, we just have people who are spending up to £80 for something like a present, and then big money, and there's no middle ground in a sense. And I think maybe, well, that's where Coracle Price is actually at this moment. I don't know how this can be remedied very quickly. Probably can't.
Well, now I'm in the Galazzi La Placa gallery stand and talking to Joe La Placa. Joe, what's your response to the fair so far?
The fair has been very slow, as a matter of fact. I have to say that I'm a little disappointed with the organization of the fair and the people who have shown up at the fair.
How would you describe the work that you're showing, which, I mean, we've all heard quite a lot about sort of graffiti work, and you're showing, what, about five large panels of it, and so on?
Basically, the exhibition is entitled Four Generations of Grandmasters and Assassins of the Letter. And this connotates and corresponds to four generations of writers, four separate evolutions of the letters from the late 60s to the present time.
And what has the response been to it here at the fair?
Basically, I mean, people are sort of a little astounded, I would say. I mean, they're a little astounded. And also, to a certain extent, we've been getting a sort of mixed extreme response. Either they like it very much or they sort of don't like it at all. They say they've seen it before, which is highly unlikely because... As a matter of fact, you might have imitations of the original writers that we're seeing here now, assimilations by the world of fashion here. But many people don't really know that this movement really is based on the idea of the evolution and liberation of the letter, the ability for the letter to serve as an attack mechanism in a world of mass-mediated society.
And the artist in question, well, I suppose you say four generations, so... the artists are all quite young.
Basically, the range of the artists are from 18 to 35 years old.
Have they come over here for this fair?
We have one of our artists here who actually did a mural outside of the fair, who's Sharp.
Right. Well, now I'm on the Waddington Galleries stand here at the art fair, talking to Sarah Schott. How have the Waddington Galleries found the fair so far?
We are extremely happy with it. It's attracted an enormous number of people, a lot of whom I think probably would not have come to see us in Cork Street. We've made a number of sales and a number of new contacts, and altogether no complaints at all.
So the fair as a whole has really worked for Waddington Galleries?
It seems to have, and it has a very good atmosphere, and I think probably you would find that most of the exhibitors were very happy.
Now I'm on the Edward Tota stand. Talking to Edward Tota, how do you find the fair? I mean, how has it worked for you?
It's okay. It works okay. There's a lot of people. The problem is that there's too many bad foreign galleries and some very good English ones. And there should be more foreign galleries to make it more international, because right now it's very local.
You've got mainly a Stephen McKenna one-person show in this particular enclosure, haven't you?
Yes.
I mean, you decided to do that rather than to sort of have a range of work.
I prefer to have works that are cohesive together rather than just a mixture of artists that have nothing to do with each other. Mm. So I decided to do McKenna and a little enclosure and Picasso another one and mix the two. Picasso has been a disappointment. Last year in the fair we sold all the Picassos we had. This year none. So I wonder why.
But I see some red dots around this particular show of Stevens.
Yes, a couple. Very small drawings. No, in general, we didn't sell very much. We didn't cover our costs, which were extremely high. It cost a lot to rent the space. This is about £4,000. £4,000, which is exorbitant. Mm. It's half the rent on my gallery for a year.
So this is Gallery Klinzinger from Innsbruck, and just your comments on the art fair.
I was always convinced that there would be or there are collectors for international avant-garde art. But my experience is that there are none, and that is because there's not enough information in this country about international actual art. And perhaps also the organizers here should make more contact between the galleries and the museums, and also the galleries here in London with the international galleries. I mean, that I think they should really do.
Well, now I'm on the Gracia Mansion stand, talking to Sir Rodney. Sir, how have you found the art fair?
Well, all in all, I think it's like exciting to be in a place this humongous with this many galleries. I think our presence here has been a bit of a shock, and although a lot of people are familiar with the gallery, they're not as familiar with their artists. So I think they don't quite know how to take it. But we have managed to do some good business here with other galleries, and I think that the audiences here that have gotten any kind of imprint from what they've seen here, they can expect to see more of it in the near future.
So, I mean, what about the fair itself? I mean, how do you I mean, has it worked for you, this being in this art fair in London?
Well, we quite really didn't know what to expect at all, and we didn't really have any expectations, but to represent as many of our artists as we could in a space this size. So most of the artwork that we do have here is of a fairly modest size. Most of the artists here work in a larger scale or work more with environments. But I feel good about it. You know, we've had some really interesting dialogue, and there seems to have been interest from surprising sources, and I don't know, I'm pleased.
Now I'm on the Listen Gallery stand talking to Nicholas Logsdale. Nicholas, how have you found this fair this year?
About 500% better than last time. We've done excellent business with surprisingly all British clients, but there's great room for improvement.
So, I mean, the fair generally then has been quite a success for the Listen Gallery.
It's been terrific for us, and I hope it's been good for other people. I think that one of the big problems is that people don't take the trouble to look at the foreign galleries because they're not used to it and they're not familiar with the people who run them. And so it's a little dispiriting for them to come all this way. And they need more encouragement. Mm.
I mean, what about the fair in the British context? Because this is, what, the second one, but it seems quite unique. Do you think it works within this context?
We don't have any biennales here. We don't have any big international shows. And on the basis that we don't have that, at least this is something that gets close to that. It gives people an opportunity to see an enormous variety of work, make up their own minds.
So the exercise has been well worth it from your point of view?
Yes.
I'm in the Nicola Jacobs space now. Nicola, how has the fair been for you?
I have to admit it, and I hate to admit to be wrong, but it's actually been a lot better than I really expected. In terms of, not only really in terms of sales, but also in terms of just general interest and hopefully people who will now follow up and come to the gallery. Mm. And really, I think what's been important as far as I'm concerned is that with the sales that we have sold to new clients, not people who already buy from us, but in fact new people who, most of them haven't even been to the gallery in Cork Street. So I'm really very pleased by the response and even the response from those who aren't buying, but just the general level of interest.
So you think the fair is important in the British context because it's quite unique in a sense?
I think it is important. At the moment it's not really international. There aren't that many foreign people here, and I'm afraid that I am slightly disappointed by the foreign galleries. I feel that they should go out next year and really try and bring in slightly better quality of gallery than there is this year, although obviously I think the English galleries are here in full force, which has definitely benefited the fair for everybody. And I do think it's important. I would really like to see the time of the fair change, possibly to later on in the year, but obviously, you know, one has to fit in with other things going on at Olympia.
Mm. So the fair's been a success, you think?
I would say yes, it has, but then I've never ever met a dealer that would admit to anything not being a success, so I'm sure we'll all say that it's been a wonderful success.
It was night, dark and empty night, everything endless in every direction. The sky above was filled with clouds. Dense, heavy black rain fell on the road, and torrents of water soaked you to your skin. Under the lamps, flashes of water lit up fierce and strong. Like a sinking ship, a car lay, its driver gone, its doors left wide and swinging. By the broad bend of the pavement, wet and slipping, were abandoned office furniture, a chair and emptied cabinet piled and soaking in the rain. The trees lining the street were stark and bare, their branches bent and swaying. the sky cleared, and by a wide junction a flood of people emptied from the covered entrance of a lighted building to the street. Ebbing slowly, they disappeared to the blanket night, the dark and lit-up subway carrying them out and underneath. We leant unlit in a doorway, our faces streaming, surveying the surrounding scene. Beyond was endless, in every direction empty and the same.
The first thing is to strike the arc up, and that's done by touching the two carbon rods inside the lamphouse together. It's very similar to an electric welding.
With one hand on the motor switch, and the other hand fades the lights down. Then at a certain point in the dimming process, you start the projector, and the film begins
the
running through the machine.
It's not clearly and sharply defined, blurred.
Check that it's still in focus, and to check that the joint's been made correctly and that the film hasn't jumped out of register to give you a line across the screen with half or a third of the picture at one side of the line and the rest of the picture below or above it.
Circle in the corner of the picture which appears over 4/24.
As the curtains reach the edge of the stage,
in
they reach
the
edge,
that's the signal,
the end of
start
the travel,
the next
light
which is already loaded on,
completely dimmed out. It should be as though the curtains were themselves fading.
The things appearing in the film as possibilities are now facts. And the film intended as a warning for the future becomes advice for the present. Advice to be heard and taken, here and now.
Meaning as I remember them, cut and fractured by the flickering frame, made huge and abandoned, belittled and unbalanced, each far-flung detail remembered and forgotten in the fight to make them real. There has been no time here for reflection or for reconsideration, enclosed and surrounded in the heat, fixed and absorbed by the vision in the air above. Dark enclosures have been left abandoned to the movements and invasion of the night, without the substance or protection of the street. This opaque and heavy blackness formed a cloud above my head, rising to the background of the grey screen. Here for drama and for epic adventure, for the chaos and oblivion of release, for the touch and the slipping of this passage, history and encounter is redrawn and readdressed in this bridge to the unreal. Darkness and emptiness beyond, the image faded. Below, the tide of gestures lit up faintly the dark rows of seats.
The sky cleared, and by a wide
flood
junction,
of people
flood
of people
from the stillness,
emptied from
and
the covered
entrance,
lighted
the covered
entrance
street.
To the street.
Ebbing slowly,
ebbing
they
slowly
disappear
they disappear
to the blanket night,
the dark and lit up
subway
carrying
them
out and underneath.
We leant unlit in a doorway, our faces streaming, surveying the surrounding scene. Beyond was endless, in every direction empty and the same.
Dennis, this is the first week of your three-month residency here at the Imperial War Museum in London. I mean, working here as an artist might be seen as a problem in that the institution itself could be viewed as an expression of the acceptance of war, in that the tokens, symbols and memorabilia of war are in a sense celebrated. And there is certainly a strong sense of that, passing the massive guns outside and the various gallery exhibitions inside. So at this very early stage, and I'll be talking to you halfway through and at the end of the residency, I mean, do you feel that there will be sufficient conceptual space or freedom within which
to stand back and to function as an artist?
That's a big question. I think the first thing I should say is that I think it's a common misconception that this institution is about the celebration of war. And I say that because I myself, only having been here a day and a half and setting up the exhibition a couple of days prior to that, I've been incredibly surprised about what this place does represent and how it functions. And I think one should try to say a little bit about that anyway. I mean, I have only just come here, but first and foremost, it's a historical institution. And as you well know, war has been one of the primary concerns of history and determining factors of historical development. So in fact, this museum is concerned with 20th century war, the two most important wars that we've had to date, and most of the other fringe wars that have happened throughout this century. And it's about collating, documenting, and preserving all of the information, objects, and whatever has come out of those two experiences. And in that sense, it's preserving it so that we can use it as a resource. And in that sense, it's like any other institution. So I don't think it actually celebrates it. I think we have to talk about that on another sort of level, the level of interpretation, possibly, or how much one puts to the way in which these things that are conserved are actually exhibited, whether there's any kind of propaganda, you know, laced into that, into the way it's presented, etc. But I don't think the fundamental concept behind this institution is that it celebrates war and therefore condones it or is in support of any kind of warlike attitudes, etc.
I mean, this is early days, as you say. I mean, this is the sort of second day of your residency here as an artist. I mean, have you at this early stage formulated any ideas about how you're going to approach being here and working here?
I have. I've tried not to think. I have actually purposely tried not to think about it too much. I've done that because I wanted to come here with a clear mind, and when I made my proposal, I made no definite plan in my proposal of what I might do when I came here. Basically because I didn't know too much about the institution, and I felt, as it is a resource, that I would, you know, be better advised to come with an open mind and see what they had, use the first 2.5 weeks to immerse myself in the archives. I have specific areas that I'm interested in, and see what comes out from it. I have, since I've been accepted, had a couple of ideas floating around in the back of my head, and what I'll do now is try to focus on those and see if there is any meat, as it were, to be had here that I can use as a kind of starting point for those ideas.
Just coming back to the actual space we're sitting in now, which is a gallery with an exhibition of contemporary work to do with war in one sense or another. And in fact, the sound we can hear in the background is from a construction you've made in the past. And there's a constant sort of milling around of school kids and visitors and so on. I mean, how do you feel about working in a setting where there is this kind of constant pressure of people moving through it? Because one day a week you have to, or you will have your studio open, won't you?
Well, I find that as, quite exciting on one level. On another level, it suits my particular attitude, because I've always felt that one should, or given the opportunity, could talk more generally about the work that I do with the public, and that the artist shouldn't, if you like, say, well, I've made the work, that's enough, it speaks for itself. I don't mind talking about it, I quite enjoy that. If it helps to clarify certain aspects, then that's a positive experience for both me and the public, or the viewer, if you like. It just depends how one manipulates that, in the sense that I make my constructions in such a way that they have a certain openness. That's my terminology. In other words, that they're balanced with a degree of ambiguity so that the viewer can use the information and it's not keyed to any specific notion I have, only to a general notion, so that I let it work. Hopefully it will work so that the thing that becomes art is what I initiate and what they look at, and that experience makes it into an art piece, if you like. And it has to be broad enough that I don't limit their experience for them to bring their own experience and therefore make some kind of contact with this work. And I think that is the same when you talk to people. I can say, well, this is the situation, this is what I intended, but how, and what one does is start to talk to them about it, to draw out what their experiences are or what their feelings were, impressions were as they actually approached it. And you can help to give them confidence that they're interpreting what they see in the right way.
Kenneth Morby, Museum of the Netherlands, is opening his studio to visitors until 5:15 a day. If you would like to meet Kenneth and talk to him about his work, please go to Gallery 5, where you will find the studio entrance.
I mean, one of the things that seemed to occur to me as we walked around after our conversation, we walked around through the various archives upstairs here, was that in a sense, I think I probably wrongly had assumed that this institution was about the celebration of war and conflict. But in fact, that was a superficial reading of what the place is about. But once you actually start digging and looking around, it soon becomes very clear that it's really about individuals' response to conflict and aggression and so on, and pain and all sorts of very alienating circumstances. But what's documented here is how that affects individuals in various kind of social situations, which would seem to, in a sense, come full circle to the central concerns of your work, you know, the idea of power and the effects of power and the effects of institutional struggles and so on and conflict.
This common misconception, if we can call it that. I certainly can understand how that has or does come about. I'm more clear about it, I think, myself now. And I think there are two aspects that are essential to identify. One is a certain kind of sensibility, which is a current social sensibility, which is anti-war. And transferring that sensibility into a historical institution is probably a bit unfair. Natural, but not placed or focused properly. The other thing is that in being an institution, which has, as I think, part of its emphasis is educational, you have a tendency of display, museum display, of the display to possibly be interpreted as sensationalizing certain things. But if you really look at it very closely, you'll realize that it's being displayed for a broad public so that it's much more clear and that it is educational, mostly educational. I don't know how to describe it, and maybe the best way is that this place happens to have a lot of objects in it, and most of those objects are war machines of one nature or another. These war machines happen to be very close to us in terms of experience, maybe not direct experience, but certainly in terms of visual experience. If we went to the British Museum and looked at a Roman or Greek chariot, which was used as a war vehicle, 2,000 years ago or 1,500 years ago, we don't look at it as a war vehicle. It becomes a cultural object. And unfortunately, all the things that are collected here are also cultural objects. But the point is that we haven't got enough distance from them to actually remove ourselves from what they mean and how they've been applied as war objects, and that we can't make that transcendent jump of saying, well, yes, but, you know, 1,000 years from now, we'll see this as a cultural object. And I think that's where a bit of confusion comes in, and where it's very difficult, if you like. It is very difficult.
So you mentioned that you were working on a piece that you've titled A Shrine. I mean, can you talk about the concerns of that piece of work?
Well, the concerns are to create an atmosphere of having walked into a tomb and finding an ark or a small sarcophagus which has some relic or relics inside. And it really is to transfer this feeling of a monument, a private monument, which is quite sacred. And I think that's really my way of manifesting the feelings I've gotten from this particular experience.
If we could talk again a little bit about the work that you've begun to formulate, or at least you felt you were beginning to formulate in the August sort of discussion called Shrine, which again you mentioned was to do with this as an institution. I mean, can you be a bit more specific about what elements of this institution are in a sense operating in that work, or will operate in that work?
Yes, they probably occupy about four separate areas. In terms of specifics, I want to bring into it some of the objects that I happen to have seen here every day as I pass through the corridors. I mean, there were certain remnants of objects from the two wars, which in terms of their material quality and images, if you like, the images that they actually create, made a sort of subliminal impact on me, and I wanted to take those particular objects and enshrine them, if you like, to make them into something else, into a more firm relic. One of the other areas was the sound archives, and I've had a lot more time listening to tapes, and I have felt that that will probably be one of the stronger elements in this work, in the sense that I shall do a very, very heavy editing in terms of selection of the type of material and how it will actually be fitted together, and how it will, you know, in terms of giving some sort of sound architecture to this work, which will be an installation. Mm-hmm. And on another level, there will be two-dimensional visual images incorporated into it, which will be things that I have lifted from the film archive. Now, when I say lifted, I mean in terms of selection, you know, selecting certain images which I think are very specifically icons of those two periods, if you like, First and Second War, and probably icons in terms of representing what one might get the feeling of a period of conflict, as opposed to a specific image which says this is war. Mm. There will be a housing, sort of dome-shaped tent-like area which you will be able to walk into. So in that sense, it's also this sort of feeling of the museum itself, as a kind of archive, as a tomb, if you like, a kind of place which is almost like a church in a way. It has that certain sort of feeling about it. It's certainly very different than walking into the National Gallery. So I think I want to draw attention to the reasons that this was originally established as an institution by Parliament, which was as a monument to all those who died in the First World War.
So you are, in a sense, dealing with much more than just the mere cultural object here, aren't you? You're dealing with its history and its sort of association.
Its association, its placing, if you like. And in a sense, the whole sort of that aspect of the after-war period, after the First War especially, when there was an incredible amount of monument building, if you like, to if you like, remind the public that this great and beforehand never experienced sort of event called the Great War should never happen again. And in that sense, I get a great feeling
a strong feeling rather from this institution that it is the British equivalent, if you like, to all the cemeteries in Normandy and around Lille and all those areas. So in that sense, you know, that influence, if you like, has come over. It's sort of permutated into the work, and that's why the work is going to be of the kind of nature that it will be. It'll take on this sort of image. But to come back to the cultural objects bit, I mean, I still do believe that these things, as most of the equipment in terms of real fighting efficiency, in terms of the kind of issues that we have to listen to and deal with in terms of defense and defense policy today, they're all terribly redundant, but they do represent the same thing in the sense that arms manufacturing is still one of the biggest industries in this country. And whilst I have in previous interviews said lots of things about those two guns outside, the cannons, and you know, what incredible objects they were and all that, that one also still has to think that that kind of manufacturing is still going on, and is it right, and isn't it a waste of time and a waste of money? So I think these are the issues that are probably compromising, if you like, to some degree, the public view of this particular institution.
There's always a big complaint, almost. It's unconscious, like this very nice Scotch chap came up to me at the opening, and he was a painter, you know, and he said, and he was an admirer of my painting, you know, he told me quite, you know, frankly, but there was a sound in his voice when he said, but you've all these changes, you know. And I said, I feel that there's a moral judgment in the way you dip thumb the vowel and changes. You know, and he paused for a moment enough to think about that. And he said, yes, I hadn't thought of it. But there's an automatic value judgment about, you changed. You betrayed us. But the idea of change in itself as a form is very alarming and frightening in terms of people. In culture, we're taught to identify, and you de-identify at great peril. And a lot of people, I suppose, flip out, you know, as an option. You know. So it's a perilous sort of journey, but nevertheless, to recognize the peril in that sense opens up the possibility of a higher ecstasy. Because in a way one feels that there is a sort of a greater desire in our being, which is to be ecstatic, to be euphoric. That there's a drive in us that needs and wants that. We try to find it in religion, in art, in drugs, you know, whatever. And in a sense, I feel that the pictures, in a way, that the paintings, is a kind of a model for a form of evolution, because after doing each picture one has passed through something, you know, and you feel that you've passed through something. There's a very definite feeling of that. You couldn't say specifically what, but even doing the show in England here, I feel very liberated from a terrible knot that, you know, I've had here for 20 years, this real knot right here, you know. And it's a feeling of alienation from my country, and that's a polymorphic thing, because one's country is one's womb, you know, sort of Mother Earth and life, you know. And the knot in my own personal life becomes a parallel to the general condition facing us all. And very often I contrast figures like Indians and primitive so-called type things against sort of modern civilized soldiers, you know, use advanced methods. And there's a constant visual metaphor going on between the primitive, direct spontaneous, against the genital organized, delay, you know, the root of civilization is based on delaying. You know, when the civilized gentleman is hungry, he doesn't just eat, he drinks 3 martinis first. When he's feeling erotic or something, there's a lot of foreplay, and maybe the whole end play is the foreplay, it never gets to the end, you know. Whereas the primitive is hungry, eats, you know, sort of erotic, he just, you know, and he's very uncivilized, and it's no fun, they say. You know. But the alienation part of the price to pay is enormous. This so-called civilizing process is enormous, you know, the reduction of the whole, the reduction of the individual to subservient to the whole is something, you know, in some political systems is very, very prevalent, sort of in communist countries. The individual is subservient to the whole, right? In America, the individual is higher than the whole, in a sense. The whole is the sum total of all those individuals being more than themselves, not less than themselves. All of those things are feelings that I've had personally. So there's a riddle in those pictures that, apart from the delivery of the riddle, which is in the form of painting as a plastic reality, and that I'm developing a painterly temperament of pleasure through the modulation. There's a lot of modulating in these paintings, do you agree? And in a way I feel the whole art world, New York trip, has betrayed the basic tenet of Cézanne, which is that he said, I'll never give up modulating for flatness, like Gauguin, you know. He would never do that because he considered flatness to be decorative, which is absolutely beautifully put.